welcome to the Humanising Health and Care podcast, brought to you by the Point of Care Foundation. In this episode, Katie Campion, head of the Foundation's Patient Experience Programme, talks with Billy Mann and Claire Dawson about why it is we don't always follow the advice given by healthcare professionals. Thank you for downloading, and we hope you enjoy.
The Point of Care Foundation exists to humanise health and care. And I've always been really intrigued by what gets in the way of that and why that doesn't just happen. My name is Katie Campion, and I'm the Patient Experience Programmes Lead at the Point of Care Foundation. Now, as you may know, we run a number of programmes on patient experience, patient-centred quality improvement, and how to use methods such as experience-based co-design. And one of the things that's so powerful about genuine co-design is that you get to see both sides of the coin. Often the things that bother professionals are also bothering patients, but in a slightly different way. And something that I've heard quite recently on our programmes is professionals talking about frustration that patients don't do what's advised. Now, of course, that's completely normal. And I'm sure that everyone listening today has at some point not followed medical advice, whether that be something small like not completing a course of antibiotics, or maybe something a bit more punchy. So today we're going to look at the other side of that particular coin. Why do patients rebel? I'm joined by Billy and Claire. Thank you for joining us, who both bring experiences of being patients. Billy, I first met quite a long time ago now when I was working clinically as a neurophysio in East London. And Claire, we've worked together quite recently on a number of experience-based co-design projects. Could you briefly introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Billy Mann. I live in the city of London, and it'll be 10 years ago this year that I had a brain injury and was taken to hospital. I was in a severe stroke that got worse and worse and worse, and I was in undergoing. I had surgery, and then I had rehab at the National Hospital, and then I kind of rejoined the world in a wheelchair, then a walking frame, and a walking stick. So I kind of, getting into the rehab thing was very lucky. I got some intense rehab when I was in hospital. I was Joe patient, and I was supposed to do what I was told, and I didn't.
Claire, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Claire. I was diagnosed with a Ewing's osteosarcoma when I was 17. So I went through quite intensive cancer treatment for about 2 or 3 years, which was pretty bleak. It was tough, and yeah, really took me away from the life that I was leading at that point. It was very isolating, and lots of experience of inpatient care. I spent a lot of time in hospitals. After that, thankfully went into remission, but the treatment I'd had was so aggressive that it's kind of damaged my lungs to the extent that I now live with this progressive lung condition, which I have to manage, which also takes me in and out of hospital, but thankfully a bit less frequently than for the cancer treatment. But yeah, what it's meant is, you know, accepting that, living alongside an illness that you kind of know you have to manage regularly, trying to integrate that into your life in some way. And absolutely, like Billy says, giving me lots of opportunities to not do what I'm told. There's lots of things I'm supposed to do to look after my lungs now. And it's, yeah, it'll be interesting to talk about which of those I do and don't.
So Billy, can you tell us about a time when you rebelled? When did you not follow medical or professional advice?
I'd like to think of myself as a rebel, because it's got quite a romantic image of, you know, biker jump, stuff like that. So, but really, I'm not very rebellious. I argue a lot, though. I'm not an obnoxious rebel. I'm more of I like to sort of challenge people. So I would often challenge my physios and OTs in hospital and say, well, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And I would argue against their expertise, and they'd have to justify themselves to me. I made myself the boss, really. I suppose that's what I did. So that's one particular, you know, when you had a brain injury, there's a lot of loss of control. Mm. And as you're progressing through therapy, you want to get back some of that control. So anything the physios and the OTs taught me during the day, I would be cheekily and sneakily doing it on my own when they weren't looking, because you were not supposed to really get out of bed or anything like that and get into the wheelchair and wheel yourself around. Whereas I thought, I'm going to work out the best way to get out of bed on my own, get into that wheelchair and start whizzing around the ward, having a look at what everybody's doing and listening to conversations. So really, I shouldn't have been doing that. That really, and when the nurses caught me doing that, they put me back and say, keep still, don't move. Secretly, I think some of the therapists really sort of liked that, because it meant that I was seizing the opportunities for myself and I was taking control of my own life. And that kind of enablement is important.
I was going to ask you actually how the professionals had responded to that. It's interesting.
Well, I was very lucky. The team I was in at the National Hospital, they were very co-productive in the sense that there was five or six of us and we were all equal members of a team. We were very collaborative. Mm. Although there was a key worker nominated, and that was the physio, Coralie, and she was notionally in charge, but really we were all working together. And I became as interested in my therapist's lives as they were investing their professional talents in my life. So we kind of rubbed along like a sort of, you know, crazy gang. Mm. And I loved it actually. It sounds a bit weird to say that when you're desperately ill, that you kind of enjoy the experience, but I really thrived on it. It was like, you know, playing football on the park when you were young.
What about you, Claire? Were you a rebellious teenager?
No. I was absolutely, I think I was quite a square teen. You know, I worked hard at school. I did what I was told. I was very much follow the rules, which is quite interesting, actually, because I was a teenager when I was diagnosed. Mm. And there was something that happened in that process of diagnosis and treatment that made me find my inner rebel, for sure. I think probably, in all honesty, I hadn't had much to rebel against until that point. It was sort of, I'd had a very happy upbringing, you know, there weren't any real problems. And so it was quite an insight that actually that first experience of suddenly, like Billy says, like the total lack of control over anything. And that brought it out in me. And I was someone who wouldn't class myself as a rebel at all. So I wonder if that's the case for lots of people, that that's what brings it out, that kind of absolutely needing to find some element of control in this situation where everything is just feels out of your control. So I wasn't until I was then.
And can you give me an example? Is anything?
Yeah, I do remember being in an inpatient and wasn't allowed to walk around because my bloods were all over the place and I kept fainting. So I was in a wheelchair and they'd said to me, you can try wheeling yourself down to the shop. I thought, you didn't say which shop. So I was in central London and decided to try going down Tottenham Court Road in a wheelchair with a drip bag that I'd just taken off the stand, shoved it in the chair beside me and just thought, well, I'll just give it a go. And God, it was a nightmare. I got really stuck because obviously I didn't have the energy to do it. And so, yeah, it was that. I was not a kind of over arguing rebel. I was this quiet, sneaky rebel. I'd say, yeah, absolutely, I'll do that. And then go off and do something completely different and not follow the rules. So that's kind of a distinct example. But I think even now, when I look at the list of things I could be doing to manage my lungs, it could, you know, I could be spending 4 hours a day doing physio, doing sitting on a nebulizer, doing postural drainage, all these things that you can do to kind of prevent flare-ups of infection. And actually, you know, I've chosen which bits I do and don't. And actually now I'm brave enough to tell my doctors that. I used to just say that I was doing everything when I wasn't. But that's been, for me, a really pragmatic, it's not like a rebellious, I'm doing it to stick two fingers up at illness or anything. It's been a really pragmatic decision rather than coming out of an emotional place. Because, you know, in all honesty, that amount of time, I'm not willing to give up that amount of time when, you know, you're not sure what your future is going to look like anyway. kind of being right, well, yes, I understand that might mean that things progress a bit quicker than they might have done. That's a decision I've made.
I was just wanting to ask Claire a question. Did you feel that you needed to take ownership of your condition?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult, isn't it? When you're first diagnosed with something, it's like such an alien world, isn't it? You don't speak the language, it's a new environment, and it's very difficult to feel ownership over a process when you don't understand the system that you're going through that process in. And so it took me time. Like, I did become quite dependent and almost institutionalized at first. I was just like, you can do everything, you can look after me, you make decisions and I'll do it. But over time, I think it's so important, particularly if you're living with a long-term condition or side effects of a condition. I definitely needed to make that. Yeah, it needed to be something I decided on before I could buy into it.
What? So you've talked about, so you do some of the things to manage your lung condition now and not others. What's the decision there? Is it around time or is there anything else?
It's around time. It's around effectiveness, like, you know, which things are balancing up sort of the time taken versus the benefit got, you know, cost benefit analysis. But also side effects that they give me. So, you know, if I sit on a nebulizer, it makes me cough all day and that takes out and then I can't do bits of work. You know, so it is a real kind of, it's an analysis in that sense, I guess. The things I feel give me the most bang for my buck, I will do.
And you said now you're kind of much more honest with professionals, you know, I'll do this, I'm not going to do that. How does that receive?
It's interesting because it's different with different people. I think the team, I'm lucky and fortunate that I've had one consultant looking after me for many years. Shout out to Professor Brown. And he, you know, he's known me a long time. So he knows what I'm going to do and not. And because there's a relationship there, that feels much easier to be upfront and, you know, honest about what's going on. I found, yeah, interestingly, if I see new people, or sometimes physios as well, because I think physio is, you know, that's their thing and they know it works. And it's kind of like, it must be really frustrating to have someone who's just not willing to do everything that you say. So sometimes there is an element of a kind of almost not understanding. So it really varies depending on who I'm seeing. You get the full gamut.
But it's that wider lens though, isn't it? Of taking a step back and seeing life. You know, you want to go and do things in your life. It's not just about the health condition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Billy, what about now? So you talked about the acute hospital setting. Being a bit of a
I was
rebel.
Going to pick up on something Claire said there, because I was thinking that the way I handled that was I wanted to take ownership of the situation, and I did sneakily do a lot of things. But what I also, I very cunningly used my therapist as well. I cheated them into giving me tricks that, because I basically said, look, when I go home, I'm on my own here now. I've got a lifelong condition that isn't going to get better overnight. There is no love tablets. There is no magic fix here. I've got to learn to live with a lifelong condition, and I've got to enable myself to deal with it. So I began to sort of trick them into giving me information about how I can build therapy into my everyday life. So I will empty the washing machine with my disabled left hand, for example. And I do a lot of things with my disabled side of my body now that I never did before, simply because in the early stages, they drummed that into me. They gave me repetition exercises to do and say, when you get out, this will serve you well. So, I really, really wanted to build it into my ordinary life and not just follow rules.
But I'm intrigued that you use the word trick. I tricked them into. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, well, I think there's a medicalization of conditions. Brain injury is a strange one because it's, you know, it's part medical, but it's also, there's a whole load of other stuff. There's a whole load of psychology attached to it. It's different. And long-term conditions, I'm sure, different from short-term conditions where, you know, the body will repair itself. My body isn't going to repair itself in the way that it was before I had a stroke. It is what it is now. I was actually honest with them and said, look, I've got, so I did need to know how to get out of the bath. I need to know how to get out, you know, so it's stuff like that. I was trying to replicate my everyday life while I was in hospital with these experts. And so I was just saying, look, this is what I'm, I kind of took charge of the situation. I became my own director in that sense.
So then my next question is why? And we talked about this already, but thinking more broadly about patients in general and their families and friends, why do people rebel?
Well, I mean, I'd say, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. And I think broadly, you can probably split them into very practical things. You know, time, not having the time to do it. Sometimes not the money, you know, financially, people get hit really hard when they live with chronic illness. And if going to a particular therapy means traveling and you haven't, you know, like it can be as much as that. Energy, you know, if you've got fatigue, just getting yourself up and making sure you've eaten three times a day can be a real challenge. So then trying to fit in exercise or something that to you feels like a real energy drainer can be really tough. So there are lots of practical reasons. I think the psychological ones are sometimes more interesting, like the sort of, I like that idea of rebellion, like just do you see yourself as a rebel? Do you like being told what to do or not? And then taking things from authority figures, how do you deal with authority figures? Are you good at that or not? That can be a reason. I think there's also an element of, for me, like acceptance around your condition. I know for a long time I didn't look after my lungs at all. I didn't take the medication properly. I didn't do. And it was a bit of a head in the sand, like this isn't happening. I'm not going to, if I start doing everything I'm supposed to do, then that's a real acknowledgement of what's going on. And I just wasn't ready. And it was scary, you know, that idea of you're going to be living with something forever. That's a big deal. And maybe if I just go on with today and ignore that, it'll, you know, and, you know, with my condition, it's almost possible to do that because it is a gradual decline rather than something that really impacts me on a day-to-day on a good day. I think that, you know, so that can all be about fear as well, fears about the future and not having had those conversations with people. And I think it's just why it's so important to talk to people about what your fears and anxieties, what have you got in your head as your worst case scenario, because if you're holding all that in, it can be a real drive to just put your head in the sand, not talk about it, not think about it, and not engage with what's good for you.
I think health professionals can quite often see that as a bit of a can of worms on both sides, actually. It's quite a big thing to open up and to have the skills and courage to kind of lean into that. But it can really unclog things, can't it? Billy?
Yeah. I think it can, yeah. But I think also if you're a patient and you work in partnership with your therapists and your healthcare professionals, then if you're able to establish a partnership, it becomes more valuable to both parties, and it's a more meaningful journey for both the healthcare professional and the patients, because it means that you're both invested in this thing, and so there's a high level of commitment there. Turning that round is really that is a mindset. Claire's right. Having that as a mindset, people who often with illnesses just think, well, the doctors are there to cure me. The healthcare professionals are meant to make me good again. But some illnesses are just not like that. And also, healthcare professionals vary a lot as well. So you can normally tell whether you are going to be able to make a partnership work with somebody, just like any other situation. A relationship with a healthcare professional is just like any other relationship. You know, you have to see, is this going to work? And, you know, do we both want it? What do we want? And so there's a whole load of stuff there that you don't really take into account initially, because it's often seen by the patients as being a transaction that the healthcare professional provides you with a solution to your problem. And it really is, it's a lot more complex than that.
So how do you know if the relationship's going to work?
If I can normally tell, because I'm very argumentative. I've always been an expert. If I see a hole, I'll dive down it. I'm that kind of, I'm like a sort of, you know, naughty schoolboy in that sense. So I've always been like that. I've always been, oh, what happens if you press that button? I wonder. So I will do that. I'm this like, let's see what happens. What can possibly go wrong? Bang. So I've done that. So I'm constantly challenging. I'm constantly looking for new ways, constantly experimenting, saying, why don't we try it like this? Why don't we try it like this? With physios, I remember several occasions when I could not get into a certain yoga position called the cat. and the physio just became so exasperated. Eventually she found a way for me to get into this cat position, and it worked. So by me saying, I wasn't just whinging and saying, I can't do it. I'm saying, I can't feel my shoulder blades the way you want me to feel them. So, you know, what can we do next? And we kept going until we found a way.
So how do you know, what would tell you that the relationship isn't going to work?
Someone who's going to be completely like bossy and managerial, I will just think, sod off.
Okay.
There's no chance of a productive relationship here.
I'm with you on that one, Billy. For me, it's also about like the kind of veneer of professionalism. Like I can't, when you've got lots of jargon, when you feel like just another patient, that's, you know, if you're dealing with this your whole life, you can very easily feel like you're on a conveyor belt going through a system. And that is absolutely disempowering. You know, I know if a doctor was going to come in and took, you know, rather than say, this is what you need to do, X, Y, Z, very informal and cold and distant. If someone came in and went, oh, well, this is all a bit rubbish for you, isn't it? How are you doing? That would just, it's just authenticity, I think, for me. And I think also another thing as well is kind of honouring the experience that the patient has. So if you've got someone who's lived with a condition for 25 years and has grown up with it, you know, I'd hope that you'd know that they have a fair amount of expertise. And so kind of rebalancing those positions of expert and professional and patient, kind of acknowledging the amount of expertise they have and what they've been through, because it's teaching your grandmother to suck eggs if you start telling me, well, physio could help. I'm like, yeah, I am aware. Yeah. And I think when you have those good relationships, what happens is, you know, you know a bit more about the wider, the holistic experience, the person's life, what's important to them, what's meaningful to them, and therefore all your recommendations about what could help are grounded in their reality, not in yours. It's not sort of like, I know from my textbook that this will help. It's like, I've thought about this, I've thought about you and your context, and actually I think this might work, you know, give it a go, but without holding on to it too tightly, like this is the solution. Give it a go and then we can chat and see if it has. And it's that sort of, exactly like Billy's been saying, it's like an equal partnership.
So to finish off, imagine you've got this healthcare professional, they're working in a busy GP practice, for example, seeing lots of patients, fairly short space of time that they're seeing people. And one of the things that I've heard recently over the last month is frustration when someone comes with a problem and you offer them advice and they don't take it. And then they might come again with the same kind of problem. So in that type of situation, what would you advise healthcare professionals to do or to be like to get that relationship, to have that partnership and to develop that trust?
It's basically, you know, it comes for me down to the partnership. How can I make a partnership with this? So if Casey, you started telling me to do various things, I'd say, and I really, it wasn't working for me, I'd say, let's find a way that we can make this work, shall we? So I kind of use that kind of language, and I'll say, let's do this together. I often do it with other people with brain injury. If they are reluctant to do something, I'll say, well, let's do it together. Doing it together is important in my case. Mm. There's a lot in that. You can get a lot from other people. So regardless of whether they're healthcare professionals or whether they're fellow patients, then, you know, form partnerships is my advice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it's kind of maybe about acknowledging the frustrations and what you're living with. So if you go in and, you know, I had this experience of saying you need to exercise more. And I'd be like, okay, well, that's a very vague description of, you know, when I feel like I can't breathe walking upstairs, like, what does that mean? And I'd freak out and wouldn't do it at all. If someone had said to me, this must be really frustrating, it must be scary when you feel you can't breathe, what is it about that experience that puts you off? You know, like, well, and also kind of, there is something about the sort of shared humanity where, you know, nobody does what they're told all the time. And I think most people have a luxury of being able to skip corners with their health, or, you know, eat what's not good for them, or drink a little bit too much. And it's almost like this expectation that when you're living with illness, you should be this perfect person who does everything that's right for them all the time. And I think maybe just acknowledging that, going, look, we all do stuff that's not great. Ideally, this might work for you, but it's obviously not. So let's have a chat about that, rather than telling you off or being disappointed or just giving you the same thing again and telling you to go away and come back in 6 weeks' time. Obviously, this isn't working. Let's have a chat about it.
Hey, so my team, let's make this fun. So I'd want us to be laughing together, trying to fix me in some way. I'd want us to have a good laugh. I'd want us to have a good time together. I want it to be, you know, good fun.
Yeah. It sounds like you both bring quite a lot of experience to your healthcare interactions now. So I thought I'd asked you my last question, but now this is my last question. What would you advise patients? So, you know, people that maybe they've just had a stroke, or maybe they've just had a diagnosis of something. What would you advise that people bring as patients to those healthcare relationships?
Pause, because it's really tricky, because it's worth acknowledging that when that has just happened, I didn't speak for myself. I didn't feel like I had much to bring. I was so kind of physically, you know, you have to dig really deep. But I think it's maybe about giving yourself the space to acknowledge what you bring, like the skills you already have. Like, you will have lived a life and done amazing things and achieved stuff, and don't forget that. You know, like, you're not reduced to just being your diagnosis. You come with a whole wealth of experience and background and context. And I think it's really hard to advocate for yourself in those positions, but if you can communicate that to the people looking after you, like, this is what I'm good at, this is what I like, this is what I don't. Be brave, because it doesn't feel okay sometimes to say those things and be a bit demanding and, you know, shout out for yourself. But I think that's really important, acknowledging what you bring to the table.
Be honest with yourself first, and then you can be honest with your healthcare professionals. And I mean, really, don't be afraid of making a mess of things. Just try it. Don't be afraid of making mess. Don't be afraid of exposing your vulnerability, because you know, they will respond to that. They want to get a big kick out of it as well.
Brilliant. Thank you both so much for joining me. It's been really, really interesting. And yeah, that's our conversation about why patients rebel.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humanising Health and Care podcast. You can find all episodes and more on our website at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk, and be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and follow us on Twitter to be notified when our next episode is available. Thank you.